Yeah.
Nothing personal, says Ray, as he drags his chair to the back of the room. I'm following you, Ray. I'm coming for you, man. A little recruitment, first of all. Next, is it? I'm starting to feel like it has to be personal.
Somebody said Timbits.
Right, that's right, yeah. Thank you, Jane. Very kind of you. So next Sunday is Mother's Day. And rather than planning to, you know, mansplain how to be a great mother, which would be one of the more ridiculous choices I could make, what I'd love us to do is have a conversation together as a community about the sacred feminine, or if you want it in, you know, vernacular, about the idea of God as mother, God as father being such a dominant idea in most of our cultural frames, not least of all because, unless Sasha sits right there, I'm going to move this way a little bit.
Sorry.
Okay. Is it better? Yeah? Okay. Because the text, you know, that the tradition that this community stands in is so almost unremittingly patriarchal. Not entirely. The sacred feminine is there, but there haven't been a lot of people historically paying attention to it. And I think Mother's Day would be a grand occasion to do a bit of that. What I want to do is have a conversation, a collective conversation about that idea and its points of resonance, its points of challenge, points of interest. And the way I would love to start that conversation is to have, I don't know, in my mind, three, four, if eight hands go up when I finish this question, that's great, but a few people who would, and again, in my preferred world, I would love to hear from female voices in the community on this, who would start the conversation by simply finishing the sentence, when I think about God as mother, or when I think about the divine as sacred feminine, if you prefer a wider frame, when I think about God as mother, I, ellipsis, finish the sentence. It can be just to the first period, it can be paragraphs long, I don't care, but I would love to hear the beginning of our conversation next week start that way. So, some of you might be just like barely sitting on your hand, ready to fling it up and say, pick me already. If there are people here already that know that you would be game for that, when I think about God as mother, I, and just to kind of get our conversation going, let's see. So this is going to take more work than I thought. Sasha's up for it.
Next awesome. Week.
Yeah, next week. Yeah, you've got a week. You don't have to do it right now.
I'm not here, but can I write
it? You mail it in? Yes.
Mail it in?
Yes. Absolutely. Thank you, Jamie.
I'd like to do it.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you. Judy? Ray? I don't know. No, it's all good. I'm going to bet this, right? Yeah. No, I'm sorry. I don't want your opinion. Yeah. No, absolutely.
You'd be surprised.
Yeah. Maybe that's the problem. That's awesome. Good, good. Okay, that's great. If anybody else sort of feels like they slide into that space where it's like, yeah, that'd be kind of fun. I do have some thoughts about that that I want to contribute to a wider conversation, and just come prepared next week to do that. Next week we're here. Let me just say it now in case I get the email wrong. Next week, okay. Next week we're here. I stopped by Creative Manitoba this morning, though, because our gear was there. Because when I left last week, I was wrong already about where we were going to be. That's where it started. And I had a nice chat with the people that are there doing a nonviolent intervention workshop. They were very kind. they beat me to a pulp and kicked me out the door. Yeah. They're training Folk Fest volunteers, so we can all go to Folk Fest feeling hopeful. If we're feeling a little crazy, that we'll be like if we kind of go sideways at Folk Fest, there are people there who are trained to help us in nonviolent ways. That actually is really lovely. They would take the time and trouble. One of the reasons I want to do what I've just talked about next week on Mother's Day is because sometimes one perspective on something really big and important gets so much weight that it's hard to consider other perspectives on that thing. And And considering a new perspective on anything is a lot of work. It's not easy. Sometimes I think it feels difficult because it's awkward. Like it takes practice, right? We have to turn something that felt like a habit, something that we felt like we knew how it worked, and we have to kind of mess with it. And when we first start to do that, we feel clumsy with it. We feel awkward with it. And that's not a nice feeling. And so even when we're feeling a little bit exhilarated about learning something new, there's still a bit of pain, usually, that goes with changing what we understand or our perspective on something. When I was thinking about this last week, the thing that came immediately to my mind was that it feels especially painful to have this experience with a lesson or a skill that arrived without seeing it coming, even when we felt like we should have seen it coming. And so for me, the instance that comes immediately to mind is renavigating white male privilege. I'm all of those, right? I'm white, I'm male. By any global measure, and most local ones, I'm privileged. And until relatively recently, I probably would have said with relatively little hesitation that those things just meant that I won the birth lottery. Like, I was born in a time and place where being white and male almost, not quite, but almost, automatically meant that you started off in a position of privilege. Cultural change being the slow-moving beast that it is, I think that is still the case more often than not in most of the settings where I live. And I would suggest that is the case because my experience is that I can make all kinds of assumptions about how a conversation is going to feel in a huge variety of situations and have that perspective go relatively unchallenged based on my experience. That they do tend to feel like I think they're going to feel. And I realize a lot of this is about, you know, the perceiver. But there's not much happening in a lot of those situations to challenge that, at least not challenge it enough to break through my perception. And that's a problem on a lot of levels, one of which is that it makes the work of changing my own perspective on those dynamics a little bit more of an uphill climb. I'm not whining about the work, just trying to observe some of the dynamics of my own limited experience. Another thing that I've observed that goes along with that is that when people do call me out on things like this, and as some of you in this community have been known to do, I find that my response time in moving from being annoyed to being open is getting better. And that I still have a measurable response time could point to either the problem or incremental progress. I mean, it just depends on your perspective, right? But either way, I mention that with a mixture of regret and hope because it suggests to me that progress is being made at the same time exactly that it suggests, wouldn't it be great if I didn't have this problem in the first place. So it's always that mix, right? In the talky bit 2 weeks ago, we explored some ideas about tacit knowing, the ways in which we know things that can't be tidally or concretely or conveyed with language. And then last week, we connected some of those explorations to the characteristics of a renewable mind, to the idea that if we want to be transformed in how we think and act, we need to cultivate some habits of mind to assist with that. And in particular, we identified the habit of having what I called an open mind, one that's honest and willing to constantly reconsider its own position and condition, and that's essential to having a renewable mind. And we also talked about a renewable mind being one that is open to creative and lateral possibilities, to putting together thoughts and concepts that we previously would have considered incompatible. That's one of the essentials of being renewable in our mind. We also considered how a renewable mind is reflective rather than just accumulative, especially relevant in the face of the barrage of information that we constantly live under. And as part of that idea, we asked the question, am I a nuisance? Which tends to be characteristic of those with reflective minds. Reflective minds tend to disturb the status quo by calling assumptions into question. And if what you would prefer is to keep the status quo intact, that's annoying. And we touched on the thought that a renewable mind is holistic, that a renewable mind is one that makes things like emotion, intuition, mystery, things like tacit knowing, it makes those kinds of things equal partners with rationality. I suppose I could sum all that up by saying the renewable mind is one that is open to change. Perhaps given the language of renewed, that should pretty much go without saying. It's hard for something to be understood to be renewable without it being open to change, it seems to me. And change, as we've just considered, can be very hard work, not least of all because it often requires not just examining, but even overturning our familiar or preferred systems of belief. Not easy stuff. When it comes to religion and spirituality, which I don't regard as the same thing, they have a very important and sometimes deeply conflicted relationship with one another. But when it comes to that sort of subset of this, Tim made an interesting observation to me after our gathering last week. I won't get this verbatim because I didn't write it down soon enough. So if I misrepresent it, Tim, just speak up. But here's what I took away from that conversation. Tim and I were talking a bit about the biblical passage that's been part of the framework for our explorations the past few weeks, which has been Romans 12, verse 2, which says, "Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." And part of what we'd been considering that morning was how having an open mind can provide a positive vantage point from which to consider this idea of do not conform, as compared to a negative perspective that primarily understands that text to point to a list of don'ts. And so we'd been talking about that idea a little bit. And Tim observed that if we think of religion as something that we make, that humans make, then that thing, religion, would fall under the pattern of this world. Which is an interesting idea, because if we want to be people whose minds are being renewed, then conforming to already patterned religious ideas is not a given. At least that's what I took away from the conversation. Fair enough?
Yeah.
Okay. And at the very least, anything we make needs to be up for review all the time. As we considered a moment ago, a renewable mind is characterized by being honest and willing to constantly reconsider its own position and condition. And wouldn't religion be a silly place to stop that? I had promised that as part of that exploration, we were going to explore a different take on an often misunderstood parable. I didn't get to it last week, so this week. Parables are, by their very nature, meant to be understandable in more than one way. That's the nature of a parable in its kind of original story form. That's how they functioned in the culture in which they were offered. And so given that given, saying that we're going to talk about a misunderstood parable might be lazy language, right? But in the religious context that I suspect most of us are most familiar with, I think I can make a pretty strong case that one perspective on this particular parable has been dominant, and I want to push on that one a bit. I know there are other perspectives, but one has kind of ruled the day. And I hope that we can do this with, you know, open, creative, reflective, holistic minds that are open to reconsideration. I'm going to give us the new version first. And then the traditional version that we find in the biblical text, and then a couple of comments about where I think the most common misunderstandings lie and what a renewable mind reflection on that might be. And if I do well, despite our late start, we should be done in good time to go for lunch and talk it over. So here's the new version. Jesus told a parable to a leadership conference, a gathering of evangelical pastors. He was speaking at the main venue. But the event was broadcast on big screens in churches all around the world. So no one had any excuse not to hear from him. He said, an evangelical, Bible-believing pastor and a spiritual but not religious seeker each sat down to read the Bible. And the evangelical pastor thanked God for the precious gift of the Holy Scriptures and renewed his pledge to continue to proclaim them faithfully. "Thank you, God," he prayed, "that I am not like the poor SBNR seeker who doesn't believe your word and can't seem to make up his mind whether Christ rose from the dead." The SBNR looked puzzled as they flipped through the pages of the Bible. Virgin birth, water into wine, bodily resurrection. "God, I don't know if I can believe any of those things. In fact, I'm not even sure that you exist as a personal being, but I'm going to keep on searching. I tell you that the SBNR seeker, rather than the other man, went home justified before God. For everyone who thinks they have arrived at their destination has actually hardly begun, and those who continue searching are closer to their destination than they realize." And then he sat down. Now, that could sound like I'm just giving the evangelical pastor character a rough ride. And that take on this version of the parable that I just shared would be entirely understandable coming from pretty much anyone in the room that grew up in or around evangelical Christianity. And it would so dramatically miss the point of the parable. So this is where it gets interesting. Let me read you the NIV version of the parable that we, as we find it in the Gospel of Luke, and then I'll unpack that a little bit, all right? So this is NIV translation of Luke 18:9-14, the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I am not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Now, if you grew up in the kind of Christian milieu that I just mentioned, or even around contemporary Western Christianity in general, you probably associate Pharisee with self-righteousness and hypocrisy. Part of that's due to parables like this one, in which the Pharisee character can most easily be read that way, and consequently usually is. It's a long-standing tradition, and unfortunately, in this case, one that misses the original point of the story. Parables in general, and in this context of the parables of Jesus in particular, do not exist to reinforce our existing values. That's not why they're there. And if we came into this parable thinking of Pharisaical as self-righteous, that's what we'll see in the story. We will get exactly what we expected from the story. But parables are meant to overturn our existing values, not to reinforce them. And that's why when Jesus told some of his most well-known parables, people wanted to get their hands on him to lynch him or throw him off a cliff, which is not the way we usually react when someone tells us what we already believe or what we wanted to hear or what we expected to hear, right? That's not our typical reaction to that kind of communication. That person gets a warm handshake and a well done at the end of the conference. The person who told us what we expected to hear or reinforced what we already believe. They do not get the I'll show you the door and wish you the best of luck with your heretical podcast departure. In the instance of the parable that we have in Luke, Jesus' original audience would not have shared our most common understanding of Pharisee at all. This is the hinge this turns on. Jesus' audience, the people to whom he would have shared that parable, first of all, would have recognized the parable for what it is as a story form, which we struggle with because they're not part of our prevailing culture. But they would not have thought of the Pharisee the way that probably most of us, standing at the end of a long Christian tradition that understands Pharisee as self-righteous and hypocritical, they would not have understood a Pharisee that way at all. They would have understood Pharisees to be men of great religious dedication and deep sincerity. Pharisees, to the people of Jesus' time, would have been like people who in our time could say things like, God told me, or the word of God says, with a completely straight face, and everyone in the room would find it believable, because they were not only textual scholars, but they were people that lived by the book. And by ultimately seeing the Pharisee as the bad guy, the point of the parable can easily be lost on us. And that's why we could turn that parable inside out and it would still do its job. See, if I told that parable at the table with the intent that Jesus seems to have told it in his setting, I would flip it around. And so I would swap out Pharisee for a word like progressive or emergent, or deconstructivist, or liberal, or theistic, or post-Catholic or post-Christian or whatever label we like to use for ourselves when we think well of ourselves, that label. And the parable would still work because the point of the very shape of the parable is to upset the apple cart of our preferred view of things, our preferred system of belief. That's its job as a story form. It seems to me that the way of reading this parable that keeps it closest to its intended task of upsetting our preconceived notions or preferred beliefs, including our beliefs about ourselves, is to take the parable as primarily saying that God actually doesn't give a rip about those beliefs, which I find quite refreshing. St. Peter, you remember the guy whose shining moments in the Easter story are impulsive violence and betrayal? St. Peter is not going to be standing at the pearly gates of the assumed to be a literal place called heaven, asking us if we believed in the virgin birth, or in the bodily resurrection, or any other precious piece of doctrine that needs our guardianship to be kept pure. What a ridiculous idea. He's not going to be asking for a denominational identity code of right belief, and he's not going to be asking for a tribal identity code that flies in the face of the denominational one. What's the attitude of the character that Jesus says goes home justified before God? Well, something like whatever else is true about the universe, I can tell just by looking at the world around me and by looking at the world inside of me that there is more going on here than meets the eye. And I can tell that I need to keep looking both within and beyond myself to see the full truth about what that means, or even to move toward it. Short version, I don't know. And I know I don't know. But I'm going to keep seeking. That's the person that Jesus identifies as closer to their destination than they think they are. Taya and I have been reading this fabulous George MacDonald book, The Princess and Curdy. How many of you have read MacDonald? Sort of straight up. Okay. Not everyone's cup of tea, for sure. But if you enjoy Lewis's work, C.S. Lewis's work, then to read MacDonald is to read the person that Lewis said, I regard him as my master. No small matter. In any case, the princess in The Princess and Curdy is sort of a... I mean, MacDonald was a master of the fairy story as a story form. And so he manages to write these absolutely fantastic stories that are just, I said to Taya when we read through this little, I want to read you a little bit of this one section, it's about two or three pages long in full, that this talk that the princess gives to this young minor boy, this kind of rough boy, Curdy, who is sort of the emissary of the princess. The princess is MacDonald's picture of this is the character that just is suffused with divine light in this book. And MacDonald's not writing an allegory, we don't have to read the princess as Jesus or, you know, whatever. But just the presence of good and right and true and God just radiates out of the princess character. They're timeless. The wisdom is bottomless. I love that they're a female character. This is an old book. And when I read you this section, you'll hear MacDonald use unapologetically and unremittingly masculine language for humanity. He's of his time. But the divine light character in the book is unquestionably feminine, which is fascinating. Curdy is being equipped by the princess for a mission about which he does not know the details, but it's a mission on behalf of the princess and to the king's court and beyond. And one of the ways that the princess equips him is by sticking his hands into a rose fire, and she asks him if he knows why, and he says, well, I imagine it's to burn away the roughness of my labor, of my mining. And she says, no, that would be a terrible idea. That's not why. It's basically because that's what makes you fit for this mission. It's to make you able to touch the hands of others, and by holding their hand or touching their hand, know what's happening basically inside of them, whether they're moving toward what MacDonald calls a beast or a man. So toward humanity or away from humanity, toward fuller humanity or away from it is the picture. Mm-hmm. All right? Quite a gift that Curdy almost immediately realizes might also be a complicated one to have. princess is speaking. She says, "Have you heard what some philosophers say, that men were all animals once?" "No, ma'am." I want to get inside McDonald's head, but just this next line. It is of no consequence. But there is another thing that is of the greatest consequence. This, that all men, if they do not take care, go downhill to the animals' country. That many men are actually all their lives going to be beasts. People knew it once, but it is long since they forgot it. "I am not surprised to hear it, ma'am," Curdy replies, "when I think of some of our miners, some of his fellow workers in the mine." "Ah," says the princess, "but you must beware, Curdy, how you say of this man or that man that he is traveling beastward. There are not nearly so many going that way as at first sight you might think. When you met your father on the hill tonight," his father's also a miner, and they had had a conversation on the trail home from work. "When you met your father on the hill tonight, you stood and spoke together on the same spot, and although one of you was going up and the other coming down at a little distance, no one could have told which was bound in the one direction and which in the other. Just so, two people may be at the same spot. Just so, two people may be at the same spot in manners and behavior, and yet one may be getting better and the other worse, which is just the greatest of all differences that could possibly exist between them." "But ma'am," said Curdy, "where is the good of knowing that there is such a difference if you can never know where it is?" "Now, Curdy, you must mind exactly what words I use, because although the right words cannot do exactly what I want them to do, the wrong words will certainly do what I do not want them to do. I did not say you can never know. When there is a necessity for your knowing, when you have to do important business with this or that man, there is always a way of knowing enough to keep you from any great blunder. And as you will have important business to do by and by, and that with people of whom you yet know nothing, it will be necessary that you should have some better means than usual of learning the nature of them." Then she goes on to present him with a fantastical beast, a mutant beast, named Lena, who offers him her paw at the princess's request. And when Curdy takes her paw, he can't let go, because he says, "Here is the hand of a child. Nothing, nothing like what she looks like at all." He's completely taken by storm. Anyway, that we can come to life, including these sorts of complexities. We need to do business and we interact, and we can't know because we don't have the perspective which way someone is traveling. How do we navigate that? Well, one of the ways we can navigate that, as well as we need to take McDonald's suggestion, is by being open to the possibility that the things that we think are the last word from the perspective of the divine, the things that we hold precious, the things that we think we need to guard and keep just such and so in our beliefs, actually may be nothing like the last word for the divine. That there are things that are happening well below the surface of what we can readily touch and see and know, that are the things that are of essence in that regard. Humility alone should suggest to us that having a mind that is open to those things is the path of life. It's a very different path than the one that starts out negative and defensive of cherished beliefs and says we have to defend this. That's our main task. Maybe not. Maybe our main, most hopeful task is actually to be open to the things that are not so easily seen, not so easily discerned, closer to essence, less about easily discerned preferences. For me, that idea that the person who says, "I don't know, and I know that I don't know, but I'm going to keep on seeking," that person would be the person Jesus would identify as justified before God when they go home. That feels like both a delightful idea to me and a deeply hopeful one. And part of that hope for me would be that it would feel similarly to you. Peace.